Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your recovered heritage of music, news, and culture. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You are engaging with Song for Naldo. Song for Naldo is off Sounds and Cries of the World, which is a new album by Jen Hsu and Jade Tung. Ben Ratliff is here to talk about Jen Hsu and jazz's quest to embrace and incorporate and also to block outside influence.
Well, yeah. If it is jazz.
You want to just go right into that?
Well, sure.
You want to just jump right in?
Let's talk
about
it.
Is it jazz? This is going to be like Jazz Times 1966 cover. Is it jazz?
Well, the first thing to say is that that's sort of a boring question.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Who is Jen Hsu? Jen Hsu comes from...
She's jazz.
Yeah, well, Jen Hsu comes from Peoria, Illinois. And her father is Taiwanese. And her mother comes from East Timor. Her mother's father was Chinese. So she's got this complicated... you know, parentage. And growing up, she was the type of...
Born here.
Born and raised in Peoria, Illinois. Mm-hmm. Growing up, she was the type of musician who excelled at everything, basically. Mm-hmm. Not just in music, but also ballet. And she studied acting a little bit. Mm-hmm. She was the kind of person who was taking piano lessons and violin lessons at the same time and entering competitions on both instruments. And also dancing in the Nutcracker every year and that kind of thing. And this went on through the end of high school. But she never improvised. It was all sort of going by the rules.
But to be fair, none of the traditions that she was studying were improvisational traditions.
That's right.
And certainly as a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old, no one was going to tell a classical violinist to improvise.
That's right. Essentially, it would divert you from your path.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do with that? But, you know, when she went to school at Stanford and she took some drama classes, and immediately she was faced with, okay, now improvise. And she was sort of,
sure.
You know, what do I do? Mm-hmm. That started a whole new process of what kind of musician do I want to be? Eventually, she changed from drama to music, and she studied with an opera teacher. And I mean, we're talking about somebody whose range of reference is really kind of vast at this point.
And is it vast in a way for a jazz musician, if it's jazz, for a jazz musician of her age, is it vaster? If I were to just pluck five players out of the clubs this weekend who are that age, is her range of reference actually vaster, or is it a different vastness than the typical jazz?
Well, it's not a vastness contest.
But is it different?
I would say it's different, and it's probably bigger than than many musicians. The point is her range of reference, is unusually broad. It's not just the classical training, but the drama and the ballet, and you know the Taiwanese folk songs.
Right.
That her father was telling her about, and that eventually sort of spurred this idea of there's more there. There's something more. There's music in my own background that's not the music that's famous. It's not the music that is commercialized. There's something more there. The link, though, really, between early life and where she is now is... there's two links. One of them is being in San Francisco and being part of this. There was a label called Asian Improv, and there was a scene of Asian musicians who were interested in incorporating Asian music into a jazz language. One of them was named Francis Wong, and they worked together quite a lot.
This is in the 2000s.
Yeah, right. Just right after she graduated from Stanford, which was 2000. She was singing jazz at this point, you know, learning it all very quickly, able to sort of reach any high bar sort of immediately, and singing standards in clubs. And I think this guy Francis Wong said to her, "What are you doing? What are you going to do? Do you want to sing standards all your life?" And then just a little later, 2002, she met Steve Coleman, who is a saxophonist and band leader and teaching, educational force, sort of peripatetic educational force, and has been for quite a long time. And he essentially said the same thing to her. What are you doing? What are you going to do? Are you going to sing standards all your life? Or as he put it, are you going to make a contribution? And I think she had to figure out how making a contribution was different from working strictly within jazz and was different from working strictly within sort of formal studies of Asian music. You know, she had to figure out a way to be original.
That part of your piece really struck me because I think sometimes within jazz, and this is true with really any form that has a formalist wing. So we could be talking about hip hop. We could be talking about rock. Like, we can talk about anything.
Yeah.
But certainly within jazz, like, playing within the rules, remaking what came before you dutifully and exceptionally, there's a healthy appreciation for that kind of work.
Yes.
And perhaps
there's an absolute value in it.
And perhaps even more appreciation for that kind of work in jazz than in other forms.
Yes, we call it refinement.
Do we?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Well, if you say so.
You know, as opposed to expansion or, yes. or whatever.
So that is a thing. Now, as a sidebar,
yeah.
what do you think about the inherent worthiness of that practice versus this go forth into the world and contribute
idea? I think actually they have to coexist. I mean, I think that for a tradition to be healthy, you have to have the, you know, let's call it formalist or, you know, refinement wing. And you have to have the other wing mm-hmm. that is trying to connect toward different languages or connect towards some concept of the future or whatever. I think you have to have both.
Mm-hmm. In your downtime, are you more apt to engage with the formalists?
Dude, I mean, I love hearing, you know, Barry Harris play bebop. I mean, it's like delicious.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's very exciting in a bewildering sense mm-hmm. to encounter something like what Jen Hsu does.
Right.
I was thinking about this the other day. What are critics for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Part of what critics for is to sort of sort through and contextualize and make sense mm-hmm. of music. This is what this music is built on. This is what it comes from. These are its constituent parts, et cetera,
sure.
you know? But then you come to a point sometimes where, like, some essential greatness of some musician is sort of, like, not to be understood. You know, like when we were talking about The Weeknd the other day,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about, like, yeah, but what is it? What is it?
Mm-hmm.
This hyper-dramatic sense of darkness that he has created. Where does that come from?
Right. And I was just like, why is a dog a dog?
Yeah, exactly. The answer is what makes him able.
Yes.
What makes him who he is. There's something similar going on with Jen Hsu. What's remarkable about Jen Hsu and what looks undeniably great on paper is that, you know, she speaks 7 or 8 languages.
Mm-hmm.
She's traveled all over the place on Fulbright, you know, fellowships
yeah, sure.
or whatever kinds of fellowships. She's gone to East Timor and Korea and Indonesia and Vietnam. And, you know, she's always got a tape recorder and videos. And she's studying folk traditions that may be disappearing. And she learns dance languages. And it's amazing what she does. And everybody can see that. But then she gets on stage with her band, and after all this preparation, after all this learning, she's able to be completely open to the point where you feel like almost anything can happen.
Are the performances strictly scripted, or are they improvised?
They're scripted in that she has all this written material. She mm-hmm. has these songs that are full of purpose and intent, and yeah, they're scripted. She works with musicians who are, you know, very sensitive and great listeners and like to create the feeling of surprise. So there's lots of open space in the music. But you just get the feeling that she can just sort of do a quarter turn and go down a completely different road.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I saw her actually was in January, and it was a solo performance. And it was the most extraordinary thing because she was singing, she was playing to accompany herself this two-stringed Taiwanese instrument called a moon lute and also a sort of zither thing. She was also using movement and dance in this very mm-hmm. careful and ritualized way. And she was also acting to some degree. A couple things happened. At one point, she got to the end of a song, and then she just calmly looked toward the audience and said, "Hi," and started talking to us. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, whoa, it was quite amazing. And then at another point, a musician who she happened to know came in through the side door of the theater, thinking it was, you know, the entrance. And she sort of worked this into her very calm and collected performance. Mm-hmm. "Hi, Tony. What's up? Come on in." You know,
while she's mid.
Absolutely. While she's mid everything. She's able to do this. Mm-hmm. Similarly.
So she's basically so fluent.
Yeah.
Like, and this is the thing, and this is sort of the tension between fluency and improvisation.
Yeah.
Is that people think fluency is an end in and of itself, but really fluency is almost just a heightened state of being, which allows a freedom. That's how I like to think about it.
Fluency allows the freedom. I think that's probably how she would put it, too. Mm. That her fluency for her, in her formulation, right, is partly the result of all that study.
Right. It's funny because you talk about her almost ethnographic practice.
Yeah.
There's always you think of an Alan Lomax or folks like that, and like you want to trust them because really it's just that guy in the tape recorder. And yet, are these trustworthy narrators? Are these trustworthy? So fundamentally, do you trust her? Do you trust that what she's bringing back is true? Is it representative? Is it narrowly focused and tailored to what she can accomplish? To what degree is there any tension at play between her going and grabbing something?
Well, I don't think she's going to East Timor and coming back with the complete collected music of East Timor. I think her filter or her selection process is going after music that that isn't known about so much. And often, music involving music or dance traditions in which women are involved, or music or dance traditions or narrative song traditions in which women play a very important role. She's going to do a piece soon involving an old Korean tale about the first shaman. And it's about the daughter of a king who is expelled. You know, she's the only daughter, and she's expelled from the family. And she's set down on a jade boat down a river. And she's rescued by some couple. And then much later, when she's a teenager, she finds that she hears that her father is on his deathbed. And so what she has to do is go down to the land of the dead and bring back an elixir to save him, even though he's been treacherous, even though he's kicked her out of the house. And she does so, and this is a gesture of great power. This is a story about a very powerful woman that she's able to overcome whatever beef she might have with her father for kicking her out. So she's interested in that kind of story. She's also interested in the fact that there are like 90 versions of that story. And she wants to study all of them, all of the variations. This is sort of how her mind works.
But is it jazz?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's lay this out.
Yeah.
In order to engage with Jen Shu's jazz side, let's listen to something from a prior Jen Shu release.
Good idea.
Something a little funky.
Yeah, well, this is from, it may not be the very last record, but one or two records ago, from a record called Jade Tongue.
It is called Elliptical/Wayward Sun.
So in that song, you hear the influence of Steve Coleman's sound and his band and his style of creating music.
AKA jazz.
Yeah, well, or related to, sure, an offshoot of. With this record, Jade Tung, from 2009, I think, she was doing all these Steve Coleman-esque strategies of writing music that involved using particular intervals or pulses that had some sort of esoteric meaning. You know, Steve Coleman is very involved in numbers and esoteric meanings for numbers, and he uses those.
Like Terrence Howard.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he uses those as tools for composing. What she's done in the new record is basically to completely get away from that.
So do you feel like this Jade Tung record, you talked about earlier how she got very good very fast at a variety of forms when she was young, and then when she started doing jazz, quad jazz, she got very good very fast.
At that too, yeah.
Yes. Is this her best jazz, in quotes, record?
I'm going to say no. I saw her perform around this time and was really impressed. And I thought, well, that's great. What else do you need to do? Mm-hmm. But I think now she's gone beyond that. Mm-hmm. She's working with largely the same, well, a couple of the same people. Mm-hmm. So who she's working with now is the trumpeter Ambrose Akinmusiri, mm-hmm. the bassist Thomas Morgan, the drummer Dan Weiss, and the violist Matt Maneri. And these are all tremendous musicians. And the way she wrote the music for this record, this new one, Sounds and Cries of the World, was she intended to write a whole bunch of music using the piano, but she went for a residency at Yaddo, and she didn't use the piano that she was given, and instead she had her two-stringed axe, you know, mm-hmm. this Taiwanese moon lute. Two strings. So she can only make chords that have two notes in mm-hmm. them, dyads. And she started just improvising melodies over a vamp until they attained a sort of a shape, and she was able to, you know, sing into a tape recorder, record them, and those were her compositions. But, like, there's this improvisational flow in these songs. This record sounds like songs that are being made up on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're composed.
Because there's a tension, at least in what I was listening to. There feels things are working against each other that maybe were not that they weren't designed to go against each other, but it resists crispness. It resists a sort of elegance. And that to me was really probably the most striking thing about it.
It resists formal elegance.
Yes, formal
because,
elegance.
Because she's not notating the stuff. She's not writing it down. This is all oral.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it sounds that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think she after having poured it out, then she thought about it and started to think about, well, which harmonies should I add here and what would be an interesting third note to add to the two, lute notes. And for some of the tracks, she was able to give chords to her musicians and say, here you need to play a C or whatever. Mm-hmm. And for some of them, she didn't. And she sort of let them feel their way through. One in particular that I think we'll hear toward the end feels like a real work of intuition, like real-time intuition. Like everybody is really concentrating on what she's doing and what might come next mm-hmm. and what would be the right note to play here. And that's jazz, by the way.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
But the thing that she's doing where she's going out, absorbing the traditions of Taiwanese folk, the music of East Timor,
yeah.
whatnot, when she's bringing that back to these musicians who are yeah. on this record, is she giving them source material to work with at all, or is it all instinct?
In this case, no. Some of the songs that she does on this new record incorporate bits of old folk songs,
mm-hmm.
and she also incorporates here and there field recordings that she made.
Mm-hmm.
But her musicians don't really know any of that.
Okay,
from what I understand.
Sure. Talk to me about that tradition inside jazz of going out
yeah.
for meaning and for influence and bringing it, I would say bringing it home, but it basically decenters the idea of home.
That's true.
Yeah. So
I think that this is a more recent thing. I mean, it's becoming more common
mm-hmm.
recently. people like Jen Hsu going out to East Timor or Indonesia or whatever and coming back and bringing that stuff into her own music. You also see it in David Vireas' music going to Cuba. You see it in Miguel Zenon's music going to Puerto Rico. You see it in Amir El-Safar's music going to Iraq. Amir El-Safar is an American guy whose father, I think, is Iraqi. And he, you know, so he's doing something similar. Dan Weiss, a drummer who's on this Jen Hsu record, is a very skilled and studious Indian music percussionist, and he'll go to India. Mm-hmm. There's more of this happening now, whereas in the past, theoretically, it could have been going on all along because jazz is like unbelievably absorbent.
Flexible, yeah.
That's the whole thing about it. But, you know, let's say Dave Brubeck would go to Turkey in the 50s, mm-hmm. and he'd hear street musicians playing a folk song, and the tune would stay in his head, and he'd bring it back, and he'd write Blue Rondo a la Turk.
A la Turk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would become a hit. But
Sus.
He wouldn't spend the rest of his life thinking about Turkish music per se.
Dave Brubeck?
Well, no.
Come on, Dave Brubeck.
Well, no, there's a lot good to say about Dave Brubeck.
But that's
just not the way
touristic.
That's not the way things happened. What's going on now is not touristic at all, mm-hmm. as far as I can tell. I mean, the whole point is that these musicians are going back and returning and going again and again, and their relationships with people there, musicians, scholars, storytellers, mm-hmm. I don't know, just get deeper and deeper until finally their roles change and they're not just musicians and they become sort of cultural ambassadors. I mean, the next things that Jen Hsu wants to do is create like an arts center in East Timor and have East Timorese and Indonesian musicians working together, which is quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But and she's in a great position to do it.
Mm-hmm. And all those folks that you were just speaking of, the thing that we were talking about before about trust, and you know, this Brubeck example, for example, this is not a trustworthy engagement with Turkish music.
Trust,
Brubeck.
Trust is,
But with all these other folks, this new generation, trust and respect, do you think, are central to the project?
Well, yes, right. Whenever you're in a position like this and you're going into a foreign place and you're the guy with the tape recorder, trust is issue number one.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually talking to me about how one of her inspirations was Bela Bartok, you know, who would go collect and transcribe folk songs in Hungary and Romania and all these places. And then bring them back and work them into his own music, but needing to do the whole thing as responsibly as possible.
Yeah.
He
mm-hmm.
wrote a lot about it, mm-hmm. and his writings were really inspired her. Interestingly, Bela Bartok, toward the end of his life, lived not far from where she lives in the Bronx. Yeah, I mean, all this to say that jazz, not jazz, whatever, this is a jazz tradition that she's doing.
Why is it happening now? What's happening in jazz? What's happening with people who are choosing to engage with jazz that is making this more of a modern?
There are more people studying jazz, interested in jazz, whose backgrounds are not American, per mm-hmm. se, or with American music 100%.
Right.
So they get involved in the jazz tradition, which is deep and rich and amazing, and then they get to a certain point, perhaps, and say, wait a minute, it's time to see what's in me.
Mm-hmm. The thing about what's in me, based on what you wrote about Jen Hsu, that was not just a musical quest, that was also something of a personal quest.
Well, that's how I understand it.
Yeah. She's, in terms of recovering family history, and, you know, it seems that she was very embedded in the formal Western traditions when she was young, and has basically spent the last 10 or 15 years trying to unmake that.
I think that's right.
Do you think it's unmake or remake?
Yeah, remake, perhaps, mm-hmm. or expand. And I think she's just gotten interested in, like, now she has a voice. Now she has a method, and now she has a voice, and she has agency. She is in a position of being able to turn people on to the sources of the music that she's interested in and the culture that she's interested in. You know, I think she's continually amazed by the fact that these traditions these traditions that she studied. For instance, the tradition of singing, the Javanese tradition of singing that has gone along with gamelan music, mm-hmm. which she studied, that it has survived all this time. Looks like it's dying. Everything's always dying. But the fact that it has survived as long as it has is an amazing thing. So why not interact with it and not necessarily put it in a vitrine, mm-hmm. but, you know, add new energy to it?
What do you make of her singing?
I think her singing is quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Flexible to a point that I don't even really understand it. Mm-hmm. Like, her singing a jazz standard makes complete sense to me. Just the tone of the voice, what she's able to do with it. Singing her own original music, even better. Mm-hmm. It's also precise. You know, all that training gave her a precision of pitch and tone such that when she wants to change it slightly, you really feel it. There's moments on this record where it becomes almost acting, and she takes on a sort of older woman's voice that are kind of chilling. Mm. She's very good at it.
Okay, and speaking of singing, we're going to close out with a clip from the new album, a song called Para Pembakar Umbak, which I was very, very struck by the intensity and the word that I keep thinking of physical imagery. I'm thinking of like gravelly, dusty, almost industrial, but not in sort of an industrial pop sense, but the density of the vocals felt mm-hmm. very almost machine-like, but not Kraftwerk machines, like early 1900s machines.
Oh, yeah? You mean sort of like grit and dust?
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's how that vocalizing felt to me.
Yeah.
And it had a quality, a true textural quality.
And think about the fact that she's trained as an opera singer.
But I think that's actually how she's communicating, or rather telegraphing that intensity.
Yeah.
I think it's the training. Now that I know more about it, I think she projects in such a way that something that's ostensibly not clean can still sort of rumble.
Yeah.
Rumble. That's a good rumble at a very, very, very strong frequency.
Well, this song stood out for me. You would never know it necessarily unless you speak Indonesian, but this is Indonesian poetry. This is a track. The band did one rehearsal and one gig, and then the day after the gig, they made this record. And they had a limited time window to record. So at this point, the clock was running out. The studio time was running out. And she didn't have time to give the musicians the chords. I spoke to Ambrose Akinmusiri about it, and he said, yeah, you know, we just kind of did this. Most of the songs were recorded in one take. And I don't know whether it was after this song or another one, but he said to her, I don't know, that sounds a little rough. Like, I need to learn this better. And she said, no, it's perfect. It's perfect the way you did it, you know, with the hesitation and the mystery and, you know, you sort of know it, but you don't quite know it and stuff. This is the thing about this woman. In many ways, she is sort of a perfectionist. Mm. It is her quest to be able to speak Korean, for example, as well as possible. She just got back from spending 6 months there and got to level 2 out of 7 levels of Korean speaking ability. But then she wants to take that perfectionism and put it into a situation where
it can be destabilized.
It can be destabilized.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
On that note, Para Pembakar Umbak. Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. Thank you to Ben Ratliff. You can read Ben on Jen Hsu at nytimes.com/music. You can listen to music by Jen Hsu on our Spotify playlist. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Listen to us on any podcast-driven medium that makes you happy and brings you pleasure and destabilizes you. I'm John Caramonica. Our producers are Jocelyn Gonzalez and Tamara Best, and we will be back next week.